And did you hear on my mind every hour of the day without your sweet inspiration?
Another Tuesday night. It's 7 p.m. on the West Coast. That means it's time for the Tammy Jackson Show on the 405 Media. This is Tammy Jackson. Welcome to 60 minutes of sweet conservative inspiration. My first guest tonight is Bart Marquardt. And I want to tell you, before I get to him, I usually tell you every week first, but if you would like to do so, go ahead and interact with comments and questions on Twitter during the show. You can follow me at Tammy J, T-A-M-I-J. Now, for Bart Marquardt. Bart Marquardt was the Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of Energy for International Affairs during the Bush administration. Additionally, Marquardt served as a Foreign Career Service Officer with the State Department. That's pretty darn interesting. But currently, he's got some great articles, and he's a senior contributor at opslens.com. That's OPSLENS.com. Bart, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tammy. Thanks for having me on.
You bet. It's interesting in this modern age of technology that the show's being produced in Southern California. I'm coming live from the great blue state with a lot of red folks still in it of Oregon, and you're there on the eastern seaboard, but yet it all works with this technology. So I've just been so pleased that you were able to make it. It's very interesting, you being a Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary for Energy for International Affairs during the Bush administration. In my estimation, the U.S. has been kind of missing in action foreign policy-wise during the Obama administration, and now that Trump is in office, believe it or not, we seem to have grown-ups in charge, people like Mike Pompeo, John Bolton, etc. What are your thoughts on that, Bart Marquardt?
Well, you really hit the nail on the head there, Tammy. Obama, Clinton, Kerry, I couldn't have picked a worse group to have led our foreign policy. They really did have a policy of trying to make us absent, trying to shrink America on the world stage. Obama famously started out his presidency by going on a world apology tour and bowing to foreign leaders. And I mean, it was just shocking what he did. And allies, longtime allies, would come and privately ask diplomats and former diplomats, "Where is America? Do you care? What do you bother?" And when American leadership is absent, it creates a vacuum in the world, and people like Vladimir Putin or Hafez al-Assad or Hassan Rouhani step in to fill that vacuum. And when President Trump came on board, he said, "Enough of this vacuum. Let's go out and show American leadership again. We are in charge." And it's really been bracing for me as a former diplomat to look at it and see people come and flock to the banner, to the clarion call, and say, "Yes, we want to follow a strong leader."
Yeah, it's been so encouraging, and everybody that's been on the show, I've said he was not my first choice when everything started at the very beginning. I thought he was an interesting guy. I'd read The Art of the Deal years and years and years ago, and I thought it was fascinating, really liked that. But there were a few other people that I thought were more verifiable as far as having a record of conservative leadership and so forth. I didn't know about Donald Trump, but when it came down to Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, I figured I had no choice. I knew what Hillary would do. Even if Donald Trump was a bit of a question mark, at least He offered some great promises to do some good things, and I have just been heartened by what he's done, and no more than in the arena of foreign policy. So having you on tonight, I'm just really loving this, because I think you're somebody that's been there in that arena in Washington, D.C. Now, you've lived abroad in that capacity. Where have you lived overseas?
Yes, ma'am. I spent my career in the Middle East. I was in Jordan, Tunisia, Yemen, Kuwait, and did a couple of brief assignments in Saudi Arabia.
Wow.
I call myself the accidental Arabist. I didn't study Middle Eastern affairs in college. I didn't study Arabic in college. I came on board. The Foreign Service said they wanted people who were generalists, who could be assigned anywhere in the world. And I thought, okay, I'll make sure I'm assignable anywhere. And they came to us and said, we could use somebody in the Middle East. And I thought, well, I was making more money from my per diem than I made from my salary. And I heard that they would keep me on per diem. It was only 1/4 per diem, but they would keep me on per diem while I did my language training. And I thought, I had just gotten out of grad school. I thought, wait, you're going to pay me to go to school, you're going to buy my books, and you're going to give me a salary, and you're going to give me enough to live on. What's the longest language, the hardest language I can take? In Arabic, it was Arabic or Chinese, and I chose Arabic. And I became an Arabist. I became a State Department Arabist. Go figure.
Oh, my goodness. That's very, very fascinating. Bart, you have an article at OpsLens.com titled Trump-Putin Summit, What Putin Wants. You begin the article. The Trump-Putin Summit on July 16 is not a meeting of equals. Trump leads a superpower, but Putin does not. Russia is a regional power in economic, ideological, and non-nuclear military terms. Nuclear weapons are the only vestige of its former superpower status. Putin hopes that by challenging the United States, he can take Russia back to the glory days of the Soviet Empire. But that empire was based on the enslavement of dozens of captive nations. More than half of those nations are now members of the EU and NATO. Most of the rest aspire to membership. Now, Bart, Putin, who's a former KGB thug, I really believe he has dreams of restoring Russia's hegemony. But what mistakes is Putin making toward that end?
Oh, boy. That's a great question. And you're right. He does dream of restoring the hegemony that the Soviet Union had. He wants to restore Russian dominance over what they used to call the near abroad, the satellite states closest to Russia, and then the next belt reaching out into Central and Eastern Europe. And he's out there doing it clandestinely. He's so active in some of the Central European states. One of the biggest ones is one of the countries we think of as a close ally, the Czech Republic. But in the Czech Republic, we have, I don't know the exact number of American diplomats, probably about 25 accredited American diplomats at the U.S. Embassy in Prague. The Russians have 421 accredited
Wow.
diplomats at the Russian Embassy in Prague. They control banks there. They control the president of the Czech Republic. He's their puppet. He's their mouthpiece. They have moneyed interests that are laundering Russian money through industrial empires and through banking empires and so forth. And this is in a NATO ally and a member of the EU. And he's doing that any place he can. One of his biggest mistakes, I think, was to underestimate President Trump. President Trump went to the Brussels summit, or to the EU summit, and he called out the members. The NATO summit. He called them out for not meeting their commitments to provide for their own defense. This 2% commitment, Trump has been hammering this since the early days of the campaign. he really caught my attention. He started it probably in maybe March or April of 2016 of the campaign, calling them out and saying it's time for you to pay your 2% of your GDP for defense. That was a commitment that that every NATO state made back in 2002, and they've reaffirmed every 2 years at the NATO summit. And all Trump is doing is reminding them of what they promised to do themselves. Now, how is that weakening NATO when he goes out and he tells them you have to meet your commitments? And then he went a step further, and he called out Angela Merkel. And he said, how can you stand up and claim to be supporting European defense and transatlantic defense when you're dependent on Russia for natural gas? For the bulk of your energy supplies, you're getting natural gas from Russia, and you have all this wind power that you've built up. And you're giving up nuclear power, you're giving up coal, you're giving up these other energy supplies, and you're dependent on Russia, because if the wind doesn't blow, all you have is Russian natural gas. And he said, and now you're talking about building another pipeline, Nord Stream 2, coming through. And he especially called out the fact that a former Chancellor of Germany, Gerhard Schröder, sits on the board of directors of Gazprom, the Russian state-owned gas company. And it was kind of an implicit criticism of Chancellor Merkel, saying, hey, you know, are you corrupt too? Are you on the take? Are you planning to go on the board to take money from Gazprom when this is over? It was a very pointed criticism. And as Trump said, if you cross me, I will crush you. And that was a message to Putin as well as to Kim Jong-un. Don't mess with me. I'm being nice to you. Don't mess with me.
Right, right. I think a lot of people have underestimated Donald Trump. And I love, before he met with Putin even, they were talking to a number of people, and I was listening on Fox, and several of them said, and I just happened to be listening as I was getting ready for work to Mike Huckabee, and he said, people are acting like Trump doesn't know what he's doing. He's got John Bolton with him. He's got Mike Pompeo with him. He knows what he's doing, and he's not a rollover. He's not a pushover. If he goes in there and doesn't hear what he wants, he will stand his ground. He will walk out, whatever it takes, that he's a very tough negotiator. People are beginning to believe him, but they have not seen this before, especially during Obama's presidency.
Yeah, you know, an Arab leader, I forget who it was, said decades ago, he said, you Americans, he said, the trouble with you is your memory. He said, the Chinese think in terms of millennia. They measure time in thousands of years. The Arabs, we Arabs, measure time in centuries. The Russians measure it in decades, but you Americans measure time from one presidential election to the next. And you have a tough time remembering anything earlier than 4 years ago. 8 years is a long time in American society, and you can bring about all kinds of changes in 8 years, and people forget what it was like, even one presidential tenure ago. They forget the Bush administration. They forget the Bush 41 and Reagan administration. That's ancient history to a lot of Americans. You know, I lived through it. I don't know how old you are, but you probably lived through it as well.
I did.
And I have very clear. Yeah. And I mean, I have the earliest president I remember is Goldwater. And I remember what people said about Goldwater. I remember what they said about Reagan. About Bush 41, they just said, you know, the knock on him was, oh, yeah, he's very competent, but he's kind of a wuss, and he only responds to whatever's in his inbox. He has no agenda.
Although he was a war hero.
He was a war hero, and
yes.
He managed the crash of the Soviet Union and of the Communist Empire, and he managed the Tiananmen Square episode in China and the integration. All of these guys were great presidents, and Bill Clinton fought the economic reforms that Newt Gingrich pushed through the Congress. He fought them tooth and nail, and when he saw he was going to lose, he said, "Well, let's take credit for them." And
right.
And now he gets credit for this great economy. George W. Bush came along, and you know, after 9/11, he and Dick Cheney worked to make sure there was not another single terrorist attack on our soil from that time forward. And they got nothing but criticism for it. They managed this war, these two horrible wars that we didn't declare, we didn't ask for, but they decided it was better to fight them over there than wait for them to come over here and attack us here. And then Obama comes in and he gets the Nobel Peace Prize for being not George W. Bush. And it's very frustrating to look at the greatness of these people. And they're doing the same thing to Donald. He has been a great foreign policy president. The only thing I like better about him than his foreign policy is his judicial appointments.
Yes. I know. We'll talk about that after the break, in fact. That was my next topic, because you've written an article about that. We're going to take a quick break. I'll be back with my guest, and I know I pronounced his name wrong. This is the problem with someone that studied French for too long, but it's Bart Marcoise.
Marcoise.
Yes. And I'll be back with Bart Marcoise after the break. The Tammy Jackson Show is sponsored by Robart Companies. They are a true custom firearms and firearms finishing shop. They're located in Phoenix, Arizona. They're found online at robartguns.com. I wanted to just mention, I don't know if I've mentioned this before, but Robart's renowned for their customization work, especially on 1911s. I know there's a lot of 1911 aficionados out there. A custom 1911 is pretty darn fantastic and very legendary. They're used by some of the most elite teams in America, like the FBI's HRT team, the LAPD SWAT, and the Marine Corps. At Robart, they have a list of over 65 possible customizations, including the ITTS Wright's signature 1911 pistol that was built to famed tactics instructor Scott Wright's specifications. So, if you want to enhance, or you need to give your worn firearm new life, check out my friends at robartguns.com, sponsor of the Tammy Jackson Show.
You're on the 405.
This is Mike from the Wrestling Mayhem Show, the show where we get fans and people in the wrestling industry together to talk about pro wrestling, WWE, NXT, WrestleMania, all kinds of fun. It's a podcast party. Check it out. Wrestling Mayhem Show right here on the 405 Media.
Listen to the Wrestling Mayhem Show now 7 nights a week, 9 p.m. Pacific, midnight Eastern, right here on the 405media.com.
You're on the 405.
Let's talk tech. Tech news discussions from the people in the industry right here in Pittsburgh. Online, gadgets, startups, and more. Check it out at awesomecast.net.
AwesomeCast. It's all about tech and it's all about gadgets. It's AwesomeCast, Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern, on the 405media.com.
You're on the 405.
I love Tammy.
I love you back, Kurt, because I'm a caring kind of gal.
The Tammy Jackson Show.
I'm just one conservative gal encouraging you to keep fighting the good fight.
Tammy is what conservative insurgency is about.
Tammy Jackson, the granddaughter of legal immigrants.
In Honduras, they had 60,000 murders per 100,000, or something like that. And I thought, whoa, that is a lot.
Like every other person on the block is dead.
Tammy Jackson, the emerging threat from the West Coast.
Tammy has made herself into a rising radio star.
When we have these mass amounts just suddenly pour into the United States, we have a worse problem than we already have had with assimilation.
The Tammy Jackson Show, Tuesday nights, 10 Eastern, 7 Pacific, only on the 405media.com.
Anything for you, Tammy.
the 405.
Shop Amazon, support the 405 Media. Click on the banner on top of our homepage. Then you know what to do. The 405 Media is an Amazon associate. That means you get great deals on Amazon.com and support the Talk Alternative at no extra charge. We are the 405media.com. Thank you.
I did my best to notice when the call came down the line up to the platform of surrender.
This is Tammy Jackson back with my great guest, Bart Marcoise. If you're just joining the show, Bart Marcoise was the Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of Energy for International Affairs during the Bush administration. He served as a career Foreign Service Officer with the State Department, which we were talking a lot of foreign policy before the break. And he is a senior contributor at OpsLens.com. That's OpsLens.com. It is a great site. I was not overly familiar with it, but I am now. I've been reading his articles around there, perusing the site. I've got it linked on the show page. You've got to check it out. We were talking Putin and foreign policy prior to the break. Now I want to talk about something critical on the home front, which is the United States Supreme Court and Judge Brett Kavanaugh. But first, before we get into that, briefly, Bart, you were telling me during the break that you had the opportunity to meet Donald Trump and Melania Trump, and it was at a dinner, and your table was right next to their table. Would you tell us just a little bit about that?
Sure, I'd be glad to. We were back to back, my wife and I, with him and his wife, Melania. My chair was touching hers. My wife's chair was touching Donald Trump's, and the table was so big, the venue was so crowded. We couldn't hear the people at our own table very well, but we could hear their conversation with each other and with the guests near them at their table. And what I heard was so unexpected, it stuck in my mind. I ended up writing an article for The Hill newspaper about it during the campaign because I wanted to share it with people. He was the only time he talked was to ask people questions about their area of expertise. He solicited their opinions. He also was very solicitous toward his wife. I got the impression that maybe she wasn't feeling well or something, because he said, you know, we can go if you want to. Are you okay? She said, yeah, I'm fine. It's okay. But he was tender. He was kind. He was intellectually curious. He was like a sponge, soaking up everything that everybody at his table had to say. He kept saying, well, tell me more about that. And why do you think that? And what do you say when people say, and then, you know, he would bring up some counterexample. Completely opposite to his public persona, both then and now.
Wow. Wow. You know, and I have friends that have met with him, and I have friends who know people that have met with him. And they've all said comparable things, that he was very solicitous, kind, and gracious in person. And I know from reading The Art of the Deal that he was never shy about finding experts. His idea being, I don't know everything about everything, but I know how to find the people that know everything about certain, for instance, you know, building an ice rink, building a hotel, whatever. He would find the best of the best and solicit their opinions. And that's what he's been doing as president, I believe. You have an article up at OpsLens.com titled, If You Really Want Choice, Confirm Brett Kavanaugh, which begins, congratulations to Judge Brett Kavanaugh, President Trump's nominee to replace retiring Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy. He now faces the same old chorus from the Democrats and their leftist allies. Chuck Schumer issued a press release within minutes of the announcement, calling on him not to overturn Roe v. Wade. Even more prompt than Senator Schumer, however, were some college students in New York. They went beyond parody last week in a series of interviews conducted by Campus Reform. Student after student opined on camera that they opposed President Supreme Court nominee days before Kavanaugh had been announced. Mm-hmm. And oh my goodness, Bart, that was just it was hysterical that they were all set with signs. It did not matter whose Trump's nominee was going to be. They were ready with the pitchforks.
Exactly. And my favorite was the group that put out a press release condemning him, but they forgot to fill in his name. They had it pre-written, and all they had to do was fill in the name, and they just had that he has appointed XXX as Justice of the Supreme Court. And then they went on for a page and a half to condemn Judge XXX. And you know, I almost entitled this, Why Is It Always About Roe v. Wade? And I decided to move that down as a subtitle or a subsection. Right. Because the reason, I just got thinking, why is it that the left fear Judge Kavanaugh and others like him? And it's because, it's not because he's politically conservative, it's because he is a constitutional originalist. He will interpret the law based only on what the law says.
Right.
And he will not create law from the judicial bench. And they have misused the courts for decades to create law that they could never pass through a democratically elected legislature or through popular ballot measures like in California. Somebody will pass a ballot measure and the left will come along and they'll overturn it in the courts, because to them the courts have become a place where they can make law based on careful manipulation of a case, of an argument, of a legal verbal trick. And he is saying, no, you can't do that. If it doesn't say that in the law, we're not going to say it from the bench. You want to make that the law, go tell Congress to pass the law and make the law say that.
Right, right. And the article's fantastic. People ought to go to opslens.com and read it. It really is great. I've always been appalled that the Burger Court found the so-called right to privacy more sacrosanct than the God-given right to life. And just before we have to wrap up, you wrote, so an implied right to privacy implied in turn the right that a woman could abort a fetus she carries because it is carried within her body. Curiously, that right to control her body, invented by Roe v. Wade, was never applied to the right to get high or to refuse to wear a seatbelt or bicycle helmet or try experimental medications, even to drink unpasteurized milk. Those are great examples. And it was an absurd opinion in my estimation, and by the estimation of a number of legal scholars I really revere. And that's just kind of where we're at with the left right now. Running out of time, if you'd like to summarize this in our last 30 seconds here, Bart.
Sure. You know what I'd like to do in the last 30 seconds is sort of knit together foreign policy and domestic policy. Somebody asked me recently, does Trump have a foreign policy doctrine? And I said, yes. It's make America great again. It's America first. He's been able to do in foreign policy what he has accomplished, bringing all of these nations to follow American leadership because he first made America strong. He passed tax reform. He has this agenda of lightening the regulatory burden. That's unleashing this giant of economic growth in America that's creating the lowest unemployment almost in recorded history, certainly for blacks, Hispanics, and women. And everybody in the world wants to be part of this economic boom, and therefore they're following us. These judicial appointments and the other domestic policy arrangements he's making are what make him strong as when he goes to face other foreign leaders.
Yeah, well said. That's fantastic. Bart Marcoise, it's been an honor meeting you, and I've so enjoyed having on the show. I hope all the listeners will click on the link to opslens.com, read more of your terrific commentary, and thanks for making the time.
It was a pleasure. And anybody wants to follow me on Twitter, it's at bmarcois, at B-M-A-R-C-O-I-S. I'd love to meet any of anyone who listens to your show.
Fantastic. I'm sure they'll do so. Take care, my friend.
Thank you, Tammy. Nice to meet you.
You're listening to the Tammy Jackson Show on the 405. I'll be back on the other side of the break with poli-sci prof Travis Smith. The Tammy Jackson Show is brought to you by Camera Security Now. Camera Security Now sells and installs surveillance and access control systems for business nationwide. A site-wide surveillance system is the most cost-effective way to provide instant access to all the visual information that's critical to your business. With upfront pricing, itemized quotes, remote access to your surveillance system, no monthly fees, and same-day virtual visits, you can rest assured your security needs are in capable hands. For more information, visit Camera Security Now or call 800-440-1662. That's cameraSecurityNow.com, sponsor of the Tammy Jackson Show.
You're on the 405.
We are a bold and active voice for the unborn. We are Audio Girl Ministries, saving the lives of babies by helping moms in crisis pregnancies get past the crisis. How? Free ultrasound imaging so the woman can see the life she's carrying, and by supplying her with essential baby items, diapers, clothes, food, crib, car seat, all given with a loving and caring heart. Want to help? Log on to audiogirlministries.com and make a tax-deductible donation. audiogirlministries.com. Thanks.
Shop Amazon, support the 405 Media. Click on the banner on top of our homepage. Then you know what to do. The 405 Media is an Amazon associate. That means you get great deals on Amazon.com and support the Talk Alternative at no extra charge. We are the 405media.com. Thank you.
Whoa, a new digital music player. Thanks, Mom.
Oh, I'm glad you like it, because I can't wait to toss the big stereo. And now that we got your dad that big HD TV he wanted, we can throw out our old TV, too.
Hold up. You can't just throw out electronics.
Really?
They need to be recycled or donated.
And how would we do that?
It's so easy, Mom. Today, recycling electronics is just as easy as buying them. GreenerGadgets.org has all the info. We just enter our zip code to find a certified recycling center nearby. There are thousands of them, and new ones are being added all the time. Some of our local stores are even certified recycling locations.
I like that.
Did you know that some of the stuff in our old electronics could be used to make new products and conserve natural resources?
Well, okay then. Let's gather them up. What was that website again?
GreenerGadgets.org. We just enter our zip code and go.
Children are at greater risk than adults from contaminants carried by floodwater. Since they dehydrate faster, they need to drink plenty of fluids. If the safety of your water is in question, either use bottled water or bring tap water to a rolling boil for at least 1 minute and let it cool before use. You should also keep children away from mud and make sure they don't play with anything that may have become polluted by floodwater or sludge. From the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency.
Welcome back, everybody. This is Tammy Jackson, and I'm a little over halfway through the show, now joined by my guest, Travis Smith. Travis Smith is an associate professor in the Department of Political Science at Concordia University and the author of a new book, Superhero Ethics. Well, that's the abbreviated title. We'll get to the rest of the title in a bit. Travis Smith, welcome to the Tammy Jackson Show.
Thank you very much for having me on the show tonight, Tammy.
You bet. First of all, and we were talking about this a little bit during the break, there is a Concordia University in my area, in the Portland, Oregon area, but your Concordia is not my Concordia.
No, I work at Concordia University right in downtown Montreal, actually.
Yes. I was going to say, in Montreal, in Quebec, Canada, I actually have cousins in Quebec, and they're a husband, a wife, and little girl, and they're actually missionaries there. Very interesting. And she is bilingual. Her mother was from Quebec, And her dad, my uncle, we're all Norwegian. So she's half Norwegian, although American, and half Quebecois. So they're loving it up there because she has a whole side of her family that she gets to be close to now, and that's really something else. For anybody that doesn't know, Concordia was founded, I guess, by Loyola College and Sir George Williams University. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's a university that was two schools that got amalgamated. There was Loyola College and a Catholic institution, liberal arts college, and Sir George Williams, which was sort of your downtown big city urban university, and they were merged into Concordia University.
Aha.
Yep.
Uh-huh. So a political science prof. I love political science. I'm always interested in somebody that goes into poli-sci and then decides to teach. And I would think that would be a little bit interesting in Canada. It seems like the political climate's a bit stifling there, especially if you're a constitution-loving American. What is the climate like, and how is it teaching poli-sci in Canada?
I love my job, Tammy. I do. I grew up in Ontario, but I went to school at Harvard in Boston. So I've got education in both Canadian schools and in American schools, and was fortunate enough to get a job back in Canada, but still regarded as from away by some people for having left Canada to be educated in the United States for a while. So I was in Boston for about 8 years. Loved it there, and right. I mean, the politics in Canada and the politics in the United States can be different, bear a lot of similarities. I think given that we have access to the same news media and social media, and the internet knows no international boundaries, academic movements flow pretty freely. Academic and ideological trends tend to flow pretty freely across the borders. And so as much as Canadians often like to say that they're very different from Americans, in a way in which Canadians usually mean that they're very better than Americans, we also tend to have an awful lot in common, and so the differences can be overstated.
Yes, my two oldest cousins, two girls, went to Trinity Western University, and since they have dual citizenship with Canada and the United States, and they loved it. And Trinity Western has been in the news quite a bit in the last couple years with different things going on, and I really was highly impressed with that school and visited several times and stayed near campus and went to chapel and everything and was very impressed with it. But some great, great institutions in Canada, no doubt. Now, I have you on because you've got a new book out. I believe it was just out last month. And
that's
it's,
right.
Yeah, Superhero Ethics, 10 Comic Book Heroes, 10 Ways to Save the World, Which One Do We Need Most Now? That's the long title. But it's a great concept. Professor Smith, everybody loves heroes and superheroes or the special forces of heroes. How did you come up with the idea for this book, Professor Travis Smith?
Well, first, Tammy, just call me Travis. If we're going to talk about superheroes, there's no need to be that formal.
Okay. Will do.
And so I teach political thought. I teach political theory and history of ideas by day, and by night, I don't fight crime, but I tend to read a lot of books and see a lot of movies in which, costume crime fighters are featured. In the classroom, I find myself using a lot of popular culture references across a number of sort of fandoms in order to try to make the material that I teach, which a lot of students regard as old and obsolete and irrelevant and no longer has any bearing on 21st century society and with our understanding of justice, et cetera, and given historical injustices, et cetera, there's no reason to look back at old books. And part of my challenge is to say, no, these are actually really interesting, really relevant. They continue to speak to us. And so part of my task is to make them familiar. And so, as I said, I'll often make pop culture references of different kinds in order to make sure that different parts of the different groups in my student body you might find the material more accessible and hopefully more fascinating. And thanks to the fact that superhero movies are so popular nowadays, used to be that one tended to sort of keep one's superhero fandom to oneself. It would mark you as a social outcast when I was growing up. But now even the cool kids know everything about the superheroes. And so they provide a really good resource on which to draw in order to illustrate, provide examples for the kinds of ideas, concepts, arguments that I teach in my classes. And I had this opportunity to write a whole book on the superheroes in particular, and political thought, ethics, the kind of things that I teach, and try to take it just outside of the classroom and make it available to a broader general audience of people who might be interested. I tend to say there's two audiences for my book that overlap. One audience are people who like superhero stories. You don't have to be an expert. You don't have to have read 10,000 comic books, so long as you've got some familiarity with the movies. I focus on well-known characters, not obscure characters. And you want to think about them in a sort of more critical fashion. The book might interest you. And if you're the kind of person who just generally thinks that ethical questions are important, if you're the kind of person who is concerned about what it means to have good character, how to raise our children, and what role models should provide inspiration and be regarded as admirable and praiseworthy, and you're interested in finding out what does the popular culture today recommend, what kinds of examples of heroic individuals or personalities are there out there that we may or may not want to offer to our children or recommend to each other, then the book might interest you as well if you're interested in seeing what the pop culture says about that question.
Yes, and as I was thinking about this, I've liked some superhero movies like everybody does. You had to see Superman and Batman and all these movies, and I've seen the TV shows and whatnot. I haven't been crazy about them like some have. And it's not just young people, is it, Travis? I have friends that are my age or older that when a new superhero movie's coming out, they are just chomping at the bit because they love this stuff.
No, I mean, even comic books themselves are not predominantly consumed by young people anymore. It's no longer, hey, kids, comics on the sort of spinning racks at the drugstore. When you look at a comic book today, the advertisements aren't targeting young children with advertisements for Daisy air rifles or something like that. Now they're trying to sell us automobiles, so they know that the reading audience has gotten older. And you're right, the movies are enjoyed by all ages. Some of them are entirely inappropriate for children. There are some that I will not take my young son to go see because I see them as entirely inappropriate. Whether it's the language or the themes or the images. And some of them are clearly intended for adult audiences. And, my parents enjoy watching them too. So my parents who would, don't read it, haven't read a single comic book from my collection, enjoy going to the movies.
Yes, yes. You also have a column at the Daily Caller titled, "Can Superheroes Save American Freedom?" The article begins, "Superhero stories are not just the amusements of a misspent youth. They have serious moral significance and can teach us important lessons about the happiness of individuals and the well-being of a free society that depends on people behaving responsibly. Could superheroes even serve as role models that can save American freedom? Too many forces in our liberal democratic society today already inculcate irresponsibility, promote narrow self-interest and hedonistic indulgence, and foster sentimentality and wishful thinking. Our society too often sanctions timid passivity and outsized outrage, all in the name of compassion or justice. We either discourage or downplay everyday bravery, moderation, restraint, resilience, generosity, gratitude, decency, sociability, sacrifice, and the exercise of good judgment, all the efforts that generate and constitute responsibility towards oneself and one's community. Now, that's a pretty good little moral soliloquy right there. I could not agree more. And those are the sort of things that you can do when you're using these superheroes as an illustrative of what you're trying to teach.
Well, thanks, Tammy. I mean, every society puts forward its models of heroism. And so the heroes that a society have will tend to represent the ideals or the principles or the values of a given society, and they try to show us what we think we are like when we're at our best, or maybe who we wish we would be if only we were better than we are, who we would like to try to be, and right, superheroes are a product of American culture. Superheroes represent ethics of responsibility. They respect human freedom. Even though superheroes are people with extraordinary abilities, sometimes very smart, very powerful, capable, incredible skills, they still treat people as equals. They don't discriminate among people regarding who they should come to the rescue. They don't look at people's social media footprint to decide, well, if I agree with you, I'll save you, but if I disagree with you, then I'll treat you like a villain. They regard human life as something that has inestimable worth and dignity. And one of the other things I like about superheroes as potential role models for societies like ours is that they teach personal and interpersonal responsibility. They teach us that it's up to us to be the best possible version of ourselves. And part of being the best possible version of ourselves is to do our part in order to improve our own communities and work together with each other, recognizing that other people need assistance and that sometimes we need people's assistance as well. But superheroes never try to use their power, their presumptive virtue, their intelligence, their enlightenment, in order to presume to rule over other people. They don't think that their particular excellences and skills make them have the right to boss everybody else around and take charge. And so, right, as I said, they do a good job of representing what it means to take responsibility for oneself and one's community, but not to suppose that that means taking total responsibility in the sense that someone who might want to usurp control over others in society might imagine. That's what supervillains do, Tammy.
Yes, that's true. If you're just joining the show, my guest is Travis Smith. Travis Smith is an associate professor in the Department of Political Science at Concordia University in Canada, in Montreal, or Montreal, as my cousins would say. And he's the author of the new book, Superhero Ethics, 10 Comic Book Heroes, 10 Ways to Save the World. Which one do we need most now? I've got it linked on the show page, both by title and by the picture of the book. So when we're done here, you want to listen to every word he says, but when we're done at the top of the hour, go check it out and link on it and get yourself a book. It looks really great. In the book, you've got superheroes there. First of all, there are three main types of superhero movies. Would you describe those, Travis Smith?
Yeah, so in my Daily Caller article, I talk about there being some that are obviously just supposed to be purely amusing, and some of them, like the Deadpool movies, you couldn't possibly take these as positive role models. In fact, they don't even pretend that they're supposed to represent positive role models. In fact, they present a rather sort of cynical perspective on human excellence and responsibility. I put them in sort of the same trajectory of entertainment that has been popular since The Simpsons first hit the airwaves. And they can be a blast. They can be fun, but they don't elevate. In fact, they are precisely sort of premised on the idea that flatters our democratic prejudices to sort of tear down the excellent rather than build ourselves up. to be the best versions of ourselves. So I don't talk about them a lot, but they're worth noticing. They are amusing. There's no doubt about their popularity, but they're not edifying. They don't provide
right,
good role models.
Right.
The other two I analyze in that article. I talk about stories that happen on a smaller human scale. The Ant-Man and the Wasp movie that just recently came out, my family enjoyed, might be a good example, where the adventure doesn't take place on a cosmic level, but rather there's some difficulty, some problem to be solved that we could metaphorically think about as being not entirely unfamiliar from us. One of the things I do in Superhero Ethics as a book is try to read the characters metaphorically, downplay the fantastical dimensions, downplay the extraordinary, unrealistic adventures, and think about, well, how do they resemble us? How do the challenges that they confront sort of seem familiar to the kinds of challenges that we face, and they're just telling them sort of in a fantastical way? But there are these other movies, the Avengers movies, the Justice League family of movies, for example, that instead of taking place on sort of an ordinary, everyday scale that we could all sort of reckon as familiar with a bit of imagination, the third kind sort of are pitched at the level of global catastrophe and apocalypse. Some sort of cataclysm is threatening to destroy all humankind, and only extraordinary individuals with extraordinary minds and powers and abilities can come to the rescue, and the rest of us ordinary human beings find ourselves feeling helpless and at the mercy of these galactic threats, some sort of vast danger or cause that we couldn't possibly stop on our own. And all we can do is stand on the sidelines and shriek in terror or cheer on our favorites and hope that things will be resolved on our behalf by our champions. And in that article, I do argue that, you know, when you think of that analogously to a political model, that is concerning. That sort of gives people the impression that ordinary citizens can't do much have no choice but to maybe do nothing more than, you know, shout at people on social media as active as they get. And instead, we rely either on people who we identify as being effectively superpowered because we think that they're so moral or because we think that they're so smart, and we entrust them to solve all of our problems for us. Or we pick people thinking, if only we gave them the equivalent of the suits of armor or something, if only we armed them with all of the powers that someone might wield over us, then we might hope they would turn out to be the heroes that we need. And that kind of that kind of politics is something I regard as concerning.
Yes, yes. I want to whet people's appetites a little bit. We've got about 3 minutes left here. Let's just talk a little bit about Chapter 1, The Best of the Beastly, the Hulk versus Wolverine. Now, each of these five chapters, you've got a couple superheroes contrasted against one another, and this first one is the Hulk versus Wolverine. I have to tell you, I don't know that much about the Hulk. I think he turns green, and I know I know less about Wolverine. Nothing about Wolverine. But would you compare and contrast those two?
Sure. So what I do in the book Superhero Ethics is I do pair up 10 different heroes in order to analyze different parts of the human condition and ask which of these two heroes is more admirable. In comic books and movies, heroes, they often, fight each other before they team up to fight the villain. So I took this idea that we're going to, have them fight against each other, but not to determine who would win in a fight, but on the ethical questions, who's more praiseworthy. And so the particular chapter you're referring to, the Hulk and Wolverine, I actually think it's turned out to be fairly relevant recently, because I'm looking here at two heroes that are notorious for, let's say, being the most uncivilized. The Hulk is known for smashing. Wolverine has claws that carve and slash, and his adventures tend to be rather bloody. And in that chapter, I look at the Hulk, who's always saying he's the strongest one there is. as being familiar to us, you know, when you hear people, especially on social media, you know, who insist on being the greatest and get yeah. really angry and how dare you challenge my supremacy and this and that. And Wolverine is the kind of person that's familiar to us on social media who is indignant and will become uncivilized in the defense of their group. And how dare you criticize me and people like me? And a degree of sort of outsized outrage can follow from that sort of discourse. And so when I look at these questions that represent our capacity for outrage. Now, outrage, you know, can be, you know, turned toward a righteous cause, absolutely. But of course, acting on the basis of outrage is inherently precarious. And we can wonder whether or not if we decide that behaving in uncivilized ways, whether actually acting out in uncivilized ways or just speaking in an uncivilized way, is that something that we can do righteously? Is that something we can do in an honorable way? Is that something that is something we can keep a lid on and keep under control, or is once we embrace incivility the kind of thing that's bound to get out of control and therefore undermine the very causes for which we stand? So those are the kinds of questions that, in that particular chapter, I take advantage of the opportunity to examine these two very well-known superhero characters and ask about ourselves and our society today.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I read snippets of it, didn't have a chance to read the whole thing, but I intend to because to me it's very, very fascinating. I love the idea of ethos and mores in our lives and the idea of heroes, those willing to give their lives for others. So, and I agree our society desperately needs many of these virtues. Travis Smith, thank you so much for being on the show. As I said earlier, I have a great many friends and listeners who love superheroes movies. I hope they click on the link on the show page and buy your book. It sounds like a very fun and a deep read that we're really talk about some things that we need to be bolstering in our society. But thank you so much for taking the time to be on the show tonight.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to discuss it with you tonight. Thank you.
Well, everybody, that's a wrap. Thanks for listening. The Tammy Jackson Show on the 405 will be back next week. And I got to tell you, I'm excited because my guests in the first half hour will be Al Robertson and his dad, the Duck Commander himself and patriarch of the Robertson family, Phil Robertson. Until then, this is Tammy Jackson reminding you to wake up. Don't be silent. Let your voice be heard because we have a country to save.
I cut my teeth on the back of an old church pew. I learned to walk in the ways of light and truth, and I was told not to speak till I was spoken to. I heard it preach what I should and I should not do, and the choir sang. Boy, no more. I've seen some things that a man just can't ignore. And this world's gonna see what I'm standing for. I've kept my peace, but I can't hold my tongue anymore.